petition number 22905, Rule 4.
I can only imagine the sight of someone dressed up as a woman in what it must have been to a group of young blokes.
Well, it was, and they did a wonderful job. They some beautiful singers. See, there were people from all walks of life, professionals, amateurs, tradesmen, and everybody put their little bit in. And how the colours and things they got to do up cheeks and faces and so forth, I don't know where it all came from, but, you know, bits of brick and trees and so forth. But the concert part is wonderful. Some beautiful singing, you know. Of course, we appreciate it because we had nothing else. But anybody that could sing, sang. Anybody that could act, they acted. And the Japs used to, or not there, but in the outside camps, we had a little party, a little concert. And the Japs would be sitting there watching our things. And a lot of humour in acting as a Jap or something, you know. And we had to be very careful that we got away with it, because if the Japs didn't like it, they liked to move in and do anything. No, concert parties were wonderful, and the civilian clothes all came, as I say, from there.
As the sort of contact with the Japanese became more regular, you mentioned that you had to be careful in the concert parties. You also had to be careful when you were near them, I presume.
I'll tell you a little story. When they come onto the island, they went onto Bukatima Hill, and from there it was their OPIP, and they organised the war in Singapore. When it was over, we had to go up there and build them a memorial on this. So we took the top right off the hill all by hand and flattened it. And then we built this big memorial to them, and behind it they let us build a smaller cross for our boats. We built this up there, and we were up there. I took a working party up there one day. We're standing waiting in the sun, and we were down to nothing but a G-string, no shirt, no shoes, no nothing. And we were working away, and I was in charge of this party at about 10 or 15 blokes. We're standing there waiting, and of course they're going crooked at me, because I was there. And I said, "Where is this little yellow bastard that's supposed to be looking after us, you know?" And right behind me a bloke said, "Here's this little yellow bastard, buddy." And I, of course, nearly fell over. He was a American-born Jap who had evidently gone back to Japan and got brought into the army. And that's as far as it went, because he understood, he knew, he was educated, and and that's as far as it went. But I'll never forget, "Here's this little yellow bastard, buddy." I got caught another time up on the line. We'd built the line, and we were doing maintenance, and we were knocking off at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. There was a working party. I was late along, and between me and the sergeant in charge of our party was the Jap guard. And of course, as far as I was concerned, it was 5 o'clock. Somebody said it was 5 o'clock, and I called out to the sergeant. I said, "Doesn't that little bastard know?" He said, "What time it is?" Eh? And unbeknownst to me, he just turned and looked at his watch. He said, "It is 5:02. Well, this is the luck I carried right through the war. Any 99 blokes out of 100 would have got bashed, but I got away with both those occasions.
On the whole, how did they see you? As
just as rubbish, as nothing. Nobody showed an ounce of thought or respect to us in any way. They were taught never to become prisoners. They'd die before they become prisoners, and of course we became prisoners, and we couldn't be any lower in their mind, and they treated us accordingly. They never had one ounce of respect for us, even for officers or our officers or our doctors. They didn't show one ounce. No.
You're mentioning the concert parties. Things like religious involvement. Was that strong in Changi?
Yes. In every camp, there were the parsons and priests and so forth that were locked up with us. In Changi, they had church services all the time. A lot of big services in there. And I can remember one occasion when after we came back from up the line, a bloke named Les Kemp and give me a name in a minute, they were both in a ward or in a bamboo hut with big ulcers on their legs. And we were working at that time, and I used to go every day with a bucket of water and fill their water bottles and give them any help at all that they wanted. And and one of these blokes was a Catholic and the other bloke was a Church of England, Les Kemp, and I can't think of the bloke name. Anyhow, Les was down the dumps, really down and out. Leg just rotting away, and I went to the padre, and I said to him, I've got a bloke in trouble, you know, and I said, he's I know he follows your church, and how's the chance to go and have a chat with him? Which he did, and it was very successful, because sympathy those days was worth a fortune, and it was very successful. So I, not being a religious bloke myself, I had no idea, but I went to the Catholic priest and asked him about, I think of that about name, would he go over and have a chat with him? Which he did, and did a wonderful job. The religion gave them something to hang on to. Not me, because I'm afraid I wasn't that way, but it gave them something to hang on to. Peter Moat, was he?
Do you think that the people that had religion did better than those that didn't, on the whole?
No, I don't think so, but they did have something to cling to. Where I, see, in my case, who wasn't not religious, we had mates to cling to. They had their religion, something to support them. They also had their mates as well, you know. But yes, they. I think like religion, serious religion is today. They was dependent on it.
Was this bonding, as I understand, was strongest in the jungle? Was it something that developed strongly in Sarawak?
Yep, right from. You made your little groups, your friends, right from the start, and you stuck with them until you got sent away and you left them and you had to make with another. See, the Australians did that. Unfortunately, the poor old Englishman, he used to have a mucker, a mate, a mucker. And if his mucker died, he was on his own. And until, that's how they were. But with us, you lost your mate. You had about six other mates hanging around to look after you too as well, you know. So the Australians are very strong in that respect. But
we can talk a little bit more about the mateship as to develop as we progress. As Changi as a whole, your time there, what do you think was the worst thing about being there?
Lack of food. Lack of food was the worst thing. Not knowing. It was only these clubs and lodges and lectures and things that gave you some support. And so we had to work to prepare all sorts of things. The water was there, but we had to plumbers had to get in and work on it and get a shower. We had one room, 10, 15 foot square, and we had about six or eight showers in. They just went non-stop. There was no shortage of water. And everybody just went in there and had a shower. We were right for showers. There's every type of thing that had to be done in any world had to be done there, because we were a world on our own. It was a city. We had to cook, had to eat. They tried to start physical training classes and so forth, but that, you know, fellas weren't strong enough for that. They were getting weak with little Tucker, but it's all kept busy.
The officers I have heard were the ones that were in main contact with the Japanese. Was their attempt to sort of try and improve the conditions?
They tried and tried and tried. See, the senior officers, it would all come back to the very most, very senior. And yes, they tried. They tried and tried, but the Japs just ignored it. If they asked for a bag of rice, if they had a bag of rice, you'd get it. They couldn't have cared less. Yes, they tried. They tried to make contact. And we got to, you know, when we were on working parties outside, we'd find a house with a piano in it. And of course, we'd get to work and work on the Japs and see if we'd get our officer to go, and we'd get that piano back into the camp. We'd get back on one of our old trolleys that we used to make. And books, houses were deserted, half blown apart, and there's libraries in them. And we'd, every time we come back, we'd bring back two or three half dozen books, you know. And I remember one occasion out at, can't think of the name of the camp, in Singapore. we only had about half a dozen books between about 100 blokes. Well, what you do, you'd read three or four half a dozen pages, you tear them off and pass them on to the next bloke. And then you'd read the next, you'd tear that out and pass it on, so you'd have three, four half a dozen blokes reading the same book.
I understand it was quite difficult to keep the books intact with people wanting cigarette papers as well.
Well, that's right. See, you'd finish up, somebody would knock off a few pages of the book and you'd miss it, and then you'd hear something, you know, who's got page 52 or something, you know. But that's only one occasion we had that. When we went up the line, of course, an entirely different life altogether. Listen, Changi wasn't bad.
Boredom, obviously, is something that you have to sort of keep your...
Well, that's what I say. That's what I say. When with their discipline they try to bring in, which they did, was to stop the boredom, to keep you busy, give you some interest in something to do. And you didn't just sit around. They had to maintain the whole area. See, the acres of land we had barbed wire around us. And the only Japs were not at all time, but they at the gates in and out. To be a Jap camp, and as you came in, you get checked in and checked out, and they'd search you, but they weren't really good at searching, of course. Yeah. See, particularly Australians, they became very, very smart thieves, because you have to live. Matter of fact, Cowboy Matthews, one little incident I can tell you, old cowboy, they knew the Japs were coming in to make a search. So all this and stuff, he had some tooth powder and some razor blades and things that he'd pinched into the godowns. And he'd asked if I dug a hole and buried them and went to work. When he came home, they'd dug a new drain right through his patch, and of course he lost all his gear. That was an old cowboy. But I'd never worked in the godowns, but they brought home an enormous amount of stuff in there. Had one of the Japs eat rat powder, rat poison in there one time, rather amusing. But
was it possible to sort of have one over on the Japanese guards ever?
Oh, all the time. They were shifty. I remember a bloke coming home, and he had a 7-pound tin of bully beef coming in the guard, in the gate, and we wanted to stand to attention and be searched. He put on the ram and stood on it. The Japs walked up and down several and didn't see it. And they became very smart at hiding. See, in a G-string, you can carry a tin of bully beef without any trouble. You can walk for a mile with that in your crutch. And they learned to carry things in their mouth, and under their hat. Yeah,
in relation to making fun, possibly, you mentioned getting a Japanese soldier to eat rat poison. Did that happen often?
No. I wasn't in the go down, but this is a bloke named Sue Curry. They were in there, and they used to find everything in there, everything in these go downs, and say a case of fruit, for instance. They'd talk of the Japs all good, you know, good mucking, you know, beauty mishy, and they'd finally persuade him to let them open a tin, you know, and they'd get a tin, and then they'd knock off about four themselves and bring them home with them, you know, and. On this occasion, and I wasn't there, but this is the story that Sue told me, that this Jap, see, they weren't educated. They were just, as I say, they were just poor, ordinary Japanese blokes who had been put in the army with all this authority over us. See, and they had 100% authority over us. And anyhow, they're saying, oh, this rat boy had come up, and Sue said, oh, good muckin. Muckin was Malay, and Mishi was Japanese. And they'd say, oh, good muck, good mishy, 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 and of course, and they talked him into, in the end, to eating some of it. And the next thing they saw him down on the ground, screaming and yelling, frothing at the mouth, and some Japs rushed in and got him, and put him in the back of a truck and took him, they had no idea what was wrong, and the last they saw him going away in a truck. Well, he must have died, because if he hadn't, there'd have been some deaths in our lives, but he must have died, but that's... there was another occasion in the Jap saying, explaining in broken English, how he knew we were bloody thieves and we'd pinched this, pinched that. And he said, look, you watch. And he put, I think it was a packet of cigarettes under a hat. He said, Australians, this, that. And when he came back and lifted the bloody hat to show him the cigarettes had gone. Well, he just gave up, see. But they became professional thieves, really, truly. You know, they have to live.
How are you coping in the Changi situation as a prisoner of war? How did you generally feel by the time you were to leave?
Well, we were just frustrated. Just lived. We did the normal parades to satisfy the officers, to keep the discipline. We did the work that we had to do, such as digging holes and preparing baths and water. And see, those times we had a pair of boots and we had shirts and we did our washing and shirts, hats and everything. We had clothing, but later on they rotted off us, and then of course they rotted everywhere. But that was, Changi was just a place. But I say, I wasn't there long. And I went.
I'm interested to know then, when it was that you were to leave Singapore to head on to the railway?
Well, they made forces or groups, and the first A and B, they went by ship up to Burma and started the railway line from Burma down. And then I was in Don Force, and we went up by rail up to as far as Bangkok, and then we marched from there further on and then started the railway line from this end.
Can you tell us what it was like then when you knew that you were to leave Singapore and how you felt and what you were told?
Well, we were just told we were going out in a working party, and of course the Japs used to tell us going to better land and so forth, better things, and so we took whatever possessions we had and we just marched to the railway station, and then and that's when it started, of course, the iron sealed iron van trucks, and 50 or 60 was in there. Half the time you couldn't all sit down. Somebody sit down, somebody stand, and so forth. You want to use the toilet, they hung you out the door out the side while you're going along. And every now and again they'd stop to pick up water or coal or something on the way, and we'd all get under the water from the filler, you know. And that, and we just sweated away, and we just landed up there.
At this point, was there any possibility of jumping train and making off?
Could have done, but where would you go? Nothing to do. We all knew. There was jungle. See, jungle's a terrible thing, and you could walk 100 yards of it and you wouldn't find your way out at the time. And there was nowhere to go, and very, very few. There were a few. And what's more, later on up the line, folks that did escape and get to the jungle, they were caught by the natives and brought back, and they had to dig their own grave and got shot into it. That sort of thing, you know. Because they had our officers to watch it so as they could tell us what they'd done so we wouldn't escape. You know? But if you escaped, you were dead. That was the end of it. And they paid the natives to give us in. During the purge, the hard part, the very hard part of building the railway line, we were at a place called Kenyu 2. And Joe was there, a cowboy. And I used to work on the mines before I went there, and we were drilling holes in the rock, hand drills and hammer and tap, and then we'd charge them and blow it, and then we'd cart the dirt away. Well, they looked for somebody with a bit of experience of handling explosives, and I put myself in. So I used to, when they put their holes down, I was supposed to measure them, and where they're supposed to be down a metre, if they measured half a metre, I'd get some men with quick start, you know, and the Japs would tell them it was a metre. But I was the powder monkey there, and I had an easier job in that respect because I had to go in there. And they left me, as I say, at some point. They'd come along with a stick and measure the hole, and if it wasn't deep enough, you get the stick across the back of your head, you know. But,
this was one of the camps further along down the line. It wasn't the first one you came to.
No, this is our first working camp.
When were you told that you were going to be building the railway?
When we arrived. We had no idea.
What did they say to you? Do you remember?
They didn't say anything at all. They just brought us out and out of got up in the morning, out you went and put to work digging cuttings or building, filling culverts in, or building bridges.
So your first camp, what were the conditions there like?
I personally think it was the worst camp of all times. Fellas had harder times, but we had this continuous. It was mud a foot thick. If you got up during the night to go to the toilet, you were barefooted. When you come back, you had a bucket of water to wash your feet before you lay down on your bamboo slats, otherwise in mud. And it was a bad camp, terrible bad camp. And we went out dawn every morning, come over dark. Sometimes we work right through the night, depending on when the real purge was on. We worked right through the night, and you marched home. You didn't know where you'd been or where you're coming. You just head down and open. Folks would fall over and pick it.
What are the Japanese conditions, living conditions, in relation to? Walking around foot deep mud.
Yeah. Well, no, they had across apart from us. They have a good camps built. They had big 40-gallon drums of water for bathing in and heat baths, you know, and any work to be done over there and cleaning out the footpaths or the roads, and we'd go and do it, you know, keep it all clean for them and that sort of thing. They did pretty well. They had plenty of tucker.
The initial experience of your camp, and you suddenly realise what you're in for, how did that then affect your situation and what you were thinking?
Well, there wasn't much, there was no time, not much time, just no time. You just worked, and then as soon as you stopped working, if you could manage it, you'd have to, you'd get a little cup of rice in there, and you'd hit the sack. Often not washing because you're so tired, you're worn out, and you didn't have time to worry about what you do. You didn't know what you're going to do next day, and if you might go to any one of a dozen jobs, you didn't have time to think. You just buried your head and went ahead. At times you're in a daze for days, and you just went.
You mentioned the purge, and I understand that the Hellfire Pass was part of that. You were talking about the powder being a powder monkey there. Mm-hmm. Can you describe to us what had to be done at Hellfire Pass?
Well, I worked a week on Hellfire Pass. I was in the other camp in this K2 when I went down to Hellfire. I worked 1 week, and they took a crowd of us down to help get it finished, and We slept beside it in the jungle, in the rain. We slept there, and then we worked whatever shifts they had on there, and we went back and slept. They brought it. We cooked our rice there on the spot. But I had a week at Hellfire Park. But all it was drill and tap and explosives, then move the dirt. What was see, though, enormous cuttings, and they're only wide enough to take a train, and deep enough. And that wasn't the only cutting. We worked on another one up at this Kenyu too, but and then you took the dirt from that cutting and took it out and filled a gully to raise that up, and you carted by basket, you know, hand basket or bags with sticks through it, and that would you do all day hammer and tap. One bloke would hold the tap and turn it while the other bloke hit it, then you take turns, and the mutton flap would be coming around all the time with a stick, and Kura Kura at the top of his voice, or bang the stick if you didn't think you're going fast enough. You had to keep moving. If you didn't, then you got into trouble. There was no spell. Lunchtime, they'd give it half an hour to eat our rice. And of course, you'd eat your rice and bang, down on the ground and go to sleep. The next thing, there's one little bastard there, he used to light a cap, an explosive cap on a bit of fuse, and throw it in the middle of us, and this thing would go off, bang, and of course we'd wake up every time to start working again.
As I understand, as the work, as the railway needed to be finished, the quota came up, your daily...
Well, everything was a quota. See, what if there was a metre of hole for explosive a day, you have to dig a metre. If you dug the metre, you bloody fool, because you'd have to dig a metre and a quarter tomorrow, see? And then there was so much dirt to move, well, that had to be moved, and you got no chance of going home. Come back, he used to say. No, come back until you finish that. But you had to be wise. If you finished it too soon, well, they knew you were capable, so you got a bit of extra tomorrow. But that's when we worked the longer hours. The monsoons were coming. The railway was behind time. They wanted the railway right through to get through to India, and we were behind time. So it was bash, crash, and hurry. Well, it didn't matter if you were sick or not. See, we'd have there was sick people, And if they wanted 100 blokes to go on a job and you only had 90, well, you had to go and find 10 out of the sick blokes. And of course, the doctors were all the time trying to say they're too sick, and the Jap would poke them with a stick and say, he'd come in and say, you. And out you'd go. You carried blokes out. I remember carried out there that we were doing a check and parade in this K2 one night, dark, and there was one man short. And he just died. And he was laying in the thing, he just died. And they tried to explain, no, one man short, so they finished up, we had to come and bring him out and produce him for the count. Their minds that way, you know. Whether they had to have 100 men, they had to have 100 men, no matter if they stand on the head or whatever.
Some of the guards were harsher than others. Was that something you experienced, or were they all...?
Well, yes, there was a difference, but those that weren't harsh were soon taught to be, and they had to be to keep up with their mates, you know. See, we had a lot of civilian engineers. Well, they were civilians, but they were in army civilian engineers. And they were the bosses, of course, and these other blokes had to keep the work going. They said you could have a hole there now. These little blokes had to have it. If they didn't, they'd get a belt. They were responsible. So, no, they were all the same. There was a couple of them that we struck at times that spoke English. You could get a few words to them, you know, just such this American bloke I spoke to. But, no, they're all the same. See, as I say, I told you a while ago, the rank below you got a smack in the mouth. He didn't know he was right. The bloke wouldn't get one. And they went down and down until they got past all the Japanese, and they got the Korean cops. See, the Koreans were mostly with us. The Koreans copped it, and then they had no one to whack, so it was us, you see. It was like kicking the cat. But we had to do it.
As I understand it, a punishment literally was life-threatening. It wasn't just a slap.
Punishments were absolutely terrific. Standing to attention in front of their guardhouse for days. Just stand to attention. Not relax at all. You try it. Or stand with a brick, not an ordinary house brick, equivalent to a couple, might be a house brick or a couple. Stand there to attend to that, above your head, full arms, and your arms fully above your head. And if you looked like moving it, they were there and they'd whack you with the butt of a rifle or a lump of bamboo. Punishments like that, you know, they're punishments were really harsh because fear, there's absolute fear of them all the time. See, they had complete authority. No matter how lowly a soldier was, he had 100% power, and of course, us being white people, again, had authority over them, and nothing we could do. You had to be smart, keep out of their road. You learned.
And keeping your spirits up, was this at all... were you able to put on concerts and that sort of thing in the jungle in your particular case?
Once at K2 we had a little concert, once there. But apart from that, the mateship in the Australians, if a bloke looked like dropping his bundle, his mates got him. And they didn't just say, oh, come at it. They'd abuse him or kick him in the arse or anything, you know. They'd give you a smack in the mouth and tell you you're a bloody coward, yellow bastard, something, and you'd get out of it, you know. You have to support each other. You could lay down and die if you wanted to, but the Australians, they wouldn't let you. They wouldn't let you. And of course, as I told you before, see, we were all a West Australian battalion. We all came from West Australia. And that was the greatest asset of all. We're still the same. I've still got the same mates here now. I suppose I'd get 3 or 4 rings a week. Talking to her, just to ring up and say hello, how are you going? What are you doing? And we've still got it. We've still got a battalion association here. I think it's about the biggest of any army crowd because we're all West Australians. Yeah.
The diseases that would have come. You mentioned that you've experienced a little bit of malaria in Chang.
Yeah, a little bit of Chang. But when we got up the line, you'd have about 7 days of malaria. You still went to work, whether you liked it or not. And then you get about 7 days off it, you'd be right. You know, the next thing would come on, another 7 days you'd have malaria. It's hard to believe because before the war, if you got malaria three times, you just got taken down to the tropics. That was the end of it. Well, I wouldn't like to count every time. But I remember old Bung Haddon talking about when he had the dysentery. He reckoned he had 103 trips to the dunny one night. But when you get there, you don't do anything, you know. But I mean, that, you believe it or not, that all those amount of times he wanted to go to the toilet.